We just have to have a city manager who follows the Bethel Municipal Code.
An investigation in Bethel reveals widespread problems with the former city manager. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the federal government agrees to consider the state's petition to remove humpback whales from the endangered species list.
We think when that threat of extinction has been removed for the foreseeable future and the threats that led to its listing are gone, it's time to get that off the list.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The Bethel City Council has released a redacted version of its investigation into city contracts, nepotism, and personnel issues. The investigation led to the firing of Bethel's city manager in May. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
The investigation reveals improperly awarded contracts, special agreements, and violations of the city's previous nepotism rule. It chronicles mismanagement by former city manager Lee Foley. Bethel Mayor Joe Klaika says the case was clean-cut.
We just have to have a city manager who follows the Bethel Municipal Code.
The council hired attorney Michael Gotti in February to conduct the investigation for $40,000. The result was a 46-page report, and the council fired Foley in May. KYUK and six other news organizations made a public records request for the document the same month. The report was released Monday. The investigation outlines problems with contracts, including special agreements with the former finance director Bobby Sutton, who was being flown up from Kentucky to do budget work. Foley apparently made an agreement with Sutton without seeking competitive bids, kept an account for his personal expenses, and provided him with numerous other perks. KYUK was not able to reach Sutton Tuesday. The investigation also describes several improper agreements with a local business, Faulkner Walsh Constructors. The demolition of the old police station was not open to competitive bidding, but instead done by Faulkner Walsh to pay off debts owed to the city. Bethel Mayor Joe Klaika.
There was code that told them exactly how to do it, so there would be documentation so that taxpayers would get their best purchases with the money that we're using for the city. And that was consistently not followed. It was just special deals were given to whoever was most convenient for him to pass it out to. And in fact, it's not even always clear why he chose what he did choose, because the documentation just really isn't there.
Attorneys also found informal agreements with Faulkner Walsh to level the teen center for $19,000, which ended up costing double that, and another for vehicle removal. In addition, attorneys say Foley backdated a lease for the company at the airport sandpit, where he had been trespassing for several months at a rate of $450 per month. Owner Harry Faulkner declined to speak with KYUK. Besides Foley's mismanagement of agreements and contracts, investigators faulted the city for some problems, such as a bad billing system and incomplete record keeping for leases. In an analysis of nepotism, the report highlights Lee Foley's son, Bo, who works for the IT department. He apparently is the only union employee for whom the city pays full master's degree tuition. He also flew first class on city travel due to his height of about 6 feet 8 inches. The report also found several situations that could be in violation of the previous nepotism ordinance, but many details are blacked out. In a memo listing 29 past and present related employees included in the investigation, Lee Foley made an argument that hiring family members was quite common at the city. None had a waiver from the manager. KYUK could not reach Foley by phone Tuesday. The report also reveals inconsistency in credit card usage by city employees for personal business.
We believe the majority of the credit card purchases were probably reimbursed. The big thing would be that basically if they don't pay it back immediately within the same month, you're giving them an interest-free loan.
The report includes 4 pages of bullet-pointed recommendations, including several redacted lines. Klaika says a person to deal with the many personnel concerns is at the top of the city's list.
Probably something we didn't expect. We found out that we really need to really tighten up our human resources department. Several years ago, we eliminated the human resources position, And that's clearly been a mistake. That's left a lot of holes in the city, a lot of things that needed to be shored up a lot. So that's what we really discovered.
The city is currently recruiting for that position. The council recently made its nepotism rules more explicit and tightened up policies for credit card usage, tuition reimbursement, leave cash out, and city leases. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration will look into whether to take the Central North Pacific humpback whale off the endangered species list. The state of Alaska submitted a petition to remove the whale from the list at the end of February. NOAA announced today it has enough information to warrant further research. This is the second petition NOAA has received to take endangered protections away from the humpback whale. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Under the Endangered Species Act, the humpback whale is listed globally as one species. Julie Spiegel, public affairs officer for NOAA Fisheries Alaska Region, says Central North Pacific humpback whales migrate between Hawaii and Alaska. Now that NOAA is looking deeper into the state of Alaska's petition, the agency will study if these whales are distinct from the rest of the population.
And if so, then whether or not to keep it listed as it is, endangered, or to downlist it to threatened, or to delist it altogether.
In April 2013, the Hawaii Fishermen's Alliance for Conservation and Tradition submitted a petition to take the entire North Pacific humpback population off the endangered species list. NOAA determined it had enough information to warrant further research. In response, the state of Alaska put in theirs. Doug Vincent Lang is director for the State Division of Wildlife Conservation.
Some of the information is less clear about the recovery of whales in the Western Pacific, including the Asian area, but we thought the evidence was very clear for the primary Alaskan population that occurs in the North Central Pacific area.
NOAA scientists estimate there are a minimum of 5,800 humpbacks found in the Central North Pacific area. Whales in the larger North Pacific area are numbered at 22,000. About 50 years ago, due to commercial whaling, that figure was less than 1,400. Vincent Lang says the state's petition argues the threat of extinction for the North Pacific humpback whale is gone.
The primary threat was whaling. Whaling's been dealt with, and it's now regulated as a species under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. So we think when that threat of extinction has been removed for the foreseeable future and the threats that led to its listing are gone, it's time to get that off the list.
NOAA started an in-depth review of the global population of humpback whales in 2010, prior to both petitions. Marta Namak is NOAA's Endangered Species Act listing coordinator.
We look at things like abundance, spatial distribution, productivity, and diversity, just to try to get an idea of how the species is doing. And we look at threats to see what threats the species might be facing.
NOAA is also looking at population structure to see if any populations are doing better.
If we can separate populations out because they are different enough from each other, then we can list species by population instead of the entire species.
NOAA is including both the state of Alaska and the Hawaii Fishermen's Alliance petitions into the larger status review. The agency has already missed the one-year deadline to make a decision on the fishermen's petition. Namak says NOAA is working as quickly as possible, but doesn't have an estimate for when decisions will come out. In 2010, the state of Alaska petitioned to remove the eastern Steller sea lion from the threatened species list, which NOAA did last October. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Pavlov Volcano's latest eruption appears to be subsiding. The Alaska Volcano Observatory has downgraded Pavlov to the lowest alert level. Volcanologist Tina Neal says the volcano isn't producing new lava flows, and it hasn't released much ash since early this month.
Based on that and the fact that we're not seeing ongoing strong seismicity, we think the eruption is over. One thing we do caution, though, is that Pavlov is a type of volcano that sometimes goes through periods of pause in a longer eruptive interval, so we wouldn't be too surprised if it turned back on sometime soon.
Neal says that could happen without much advance notice.
The system is very hot and open. It's been erupting now on and off for a couple of years, so we would not expect necessarily to see a lot of earthquakes giving us warning.
Right now, Pavlov is still restless. Neil says it's undergoing small earthquakes and letting off steam and puffs of ash as it cools down. She says the AVO will be on the lookout for a temperature spike, which could foretell another eruption. The AVO has 5 volcanoes on alert in the Aleutians right now. Neil says none of them were affected by the major undersea earthquake that happened Monday near Adak. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, colorful signs with a fish conservation message show up along Bethel Roads.
If we overfish them and they're all gone and they won't come back, there's not going to be any more fish for people to have, especially kings.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Attention, Alaska gardeners. Invasive weeds are a threat to landscaping, lawns, and gardens. They can spread and harm Alaska wildlife and waterways. Potted plants, hay, gravel, and soil, even clothing and vehicles can transport invasive plants to Alaska. So learn more at alaskainvasives.org. Let's protect Alaska together. Visit alaskainvasives.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Agriculture and the U.S. Forest Service.
A physicist with the Union of Concerned Scientists is calling the ground-based mid-course missile defense system less than proven, despite Sunday's successful test over the Pacific Ocean. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The ground-based mid-course missile defense system test employed a second-generation kill vehicle that had missed its target in 2 previous tests in 2010. Dr. Laura Grego, who covers defense issues for the Union of Concerned Scientists, says Sunday's intercept of a dummy enemy missile should be looked at in context.
You know, I think a lot of people put a lot of work into making this test happen, and they should feel great that it was a success, but it actually doesn't tell you a whole lot about how capable the system is. And one reason for that is, you know, it hasn't been tested very frequently. So right now we know it's 1 for 3, which isn't great for something that you'd want to count on to defend against nuclear weapons and something that has to work the first time.
Alaska's Fort Greely is the primary staging site for the ground-based mid-course interceptor system. The 26 missiles housed there include a mix of first and second generation kill vehicle technology that Grego says together have a less than 50% success rate in tests, a track record she considers only part of the story.
Both versions have had upgrades and patches, and according to an LA Times investigation, almost all of the interceptors have differences from each other, and it's not clear that knowing that one works will tell you much about how well another one works.
Grego blames the ground-based missile defense system's less than stellar performance on its rush deployment dating back to the Bush administration.
That's why we instituted Fly Before You Buy. This was an experiment in getting rid of Fly Before You Buy, and this is the result. Not very good.
The Missile Defense Agency had no one available to answer questions this week, but a spokesman for ground-based mid-course defense contractor Boeing, Terrence Williams, says the company's confident in the technology.
The significance of this test is that it's the first intercept using an enhanced version of the EKV, also called the Exo-Atmospheric Kill Vehicle. And we remain confident in the system's ability to defeat adversaries both now and in the future.
Williams could not comment on whether or not all system missiles will be upgraded with the latest kill vehicle. The Obama administration said in March that it would not move forward with the addition of 14 new interceptors at Fort Greely unless Sunday's test was successful. There's been no word since the test on the over $1 billion interceptor buildup or other planned system upgrades, but members of Alaska's congressional delegation have heralded the success. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A new National Park Service policy prohibits the use of unmanned aircraft. As KUAC's Aaron Berner reports, it's intended to give the agency time to assess the risks and benefits of allowing UAVs in parks.
On June 20th, National Park Service Director Jonathan Jarvis issued a memorandum directing park superintendents to ban the use of unmanned aircraft in national parks. A spokesman for the Park Service, Jeffrey Olson, says the unmanned aerial vehicles being used in national parks are primarily owned by hobbyists for recreation.
They usually have a video camera that is carried aloft, and they shoot video and stills, and a lot of times they go home and they make a little video of it and put a music soundtrack on it and, you know, share it with friends or even put it on YouTube.
Denali National Park spokeswoman Chris Pfister says a recent post on YouTube shows some of the problems that arise with UAVs in national parks.
coverage of our parking lot, and they flew up and provided an overview of the area. And then at one point, the aircraft zoomed down, flew right over the nest enclosure that we have for the mugels that nest on the gravel bar, and flew under the Savage River Bridge. And so that's an instance where certainly there was high potential for wildlife disturbance and potentially disturbance to visitors who were also utilizing that parking lot.
Park spokeswoman for the state, Morgan Worthen, says Alaska has limited experience with UAVs, but there is concern about the effects they could have on the park's environment.
Our primary goal is always to ensure that we can protect park resources and ensure visitor safety while providing all visitors with a rich experience. And at this point, we have some serious concerns about the negative impact that flying unmanned aircraft is having in parks, in particular in the lower 48.
Jeffrey Olson agrees. He says that increasing availability and affordability of the technology led the Park Service to reevaluate their policy. He calls the new policy a timeout that gives the Park Service time to research the effects of UAVs and develop nationwide regulations.
We don't have all the answers, and that's why this is temporary. We like to have people in national parks, and we like to have people enjoying themselves in national parks. And if there are places where this is going to be an appropriate activity, we want to find that out.
The maximum penalty for violating the policy will be 6 months in jail and a $5,000 fine. The policy won't go into effect for 60 days. Research and development of nationwide regulation could take 18 months or more. With help from Dan Bross, reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Aaron Berner.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're having trouble taking medications or forgetting to take pills on time, there's help available for these serious common problems. Talk to your prescriber or pharmacist right away and visit meded.alaska.gov. There you'll find tips on safety, saving money, and more. When you take your medications as directed, you protect your health and independence. You protect your future. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The state's Department of Health is reporting an increase in sexually transmitted diseases in Alaska. In 2013, gonorrhea and syphilis infections were up more than 50% from 2012. Alaska was ranked first in the nation for chlamydia infections in 2013. And in just the first 5 months of this year, 23 new cases of HIV have been diagnosed and reported. That's one less than last year's total. Susan Jones with the state's section of epidemiology says it's hard to know exactly why more cases of gonorrhea and chlamydia are being reported. With thousands of people testing positive, they can't ask everyone about their sexual behaviors.
Could it be that individuals are seeking service and getting detected earlier? That could be part of it. Could it be that providers are aware that they should screen for gonorrhea and they're doing more screening? That could be part of it.
Jones says they do ask people who test positive about their risk factors. She says some of the increase is due to people meeting their sexual partners online or through phone apps.
If you're a person practicing these high-risk behaviors of having sex with individuals that you don't know, be careful.
Jones says one of the ways to stop the spread of STDs is for infected people to inform their partners and help them get treated. She says the state can help track them down.
You know, back in the day, it used to be phone calls and knocking on the door, and today it's phone apps and social media.
The state offers free treatment for people who are infected, though funding for that program runs out at the end of this month. Alaska ranked fifth in the nation in a recent state scorecard on long-term services for older adults, the disabled, and family caregivers. However, local experts say gaps in the system can cause big problems. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
AARP, the Commonwealth Fund, and SCAN Foundation developed the report released last week. Alaska's high marks were for quality of care, choice of long-term care settings and providers, and effective transitions between home, hospital, and long-term care. However, Alaska AARP Interim State Director Steve Hahn says Alaska doesn't provide enough support to family caregivers, those helping a relative with, say, bathing, dressing, or cooking.
Really, the areas that we're looking at are
making it easier for people to not really have to make those difficult choices between keeping a job and providing care to someone they love.
Alaska Long-Term Care Ombudsman Diana Winger says other states, such as Washington, provide broader support to caregivers, and she'd like to see a system similar to theirs here.
I would really support setting up a plan where we could go in and provide in-home assessments for those people and hook them into a system of family caregiver support that would be ongoing in terms of their needs and beyond just providing respite, providing counseling and, you know, other kinds of support services.
After all, according to Hahn, caregivers make a substantial contribution to the Alaska economy.
Family caregivers in Alaska contribute an estimated $1.1 billion in health care costs that would have otherwise had to have been spent on nursing homes or other institutional care.
There are 15 nursing homes in Alaska and 632 licensed assisted living facilities, almost all on the rail belt. But Winger says the quality of care in assisted living facilities needs improvement.
Currently, our licensing regulations set a pretty low bar. And considering that we're putting some of the sickest people, or the most frail people, in assisted living and having the most untrained caregivers provide care for them, that to me is not a good situation.
Alaska ranked 38th in affordability and access, quite low considering the report found the cost of long-term care services and supports is unaffordable for middle-income families in all states. Winger says Alaska's high costs have reduced access to long-term care insurance.
Because our skilled nursing services are so expensive up here, some of the insurance companies have been reluctant to offer services up here. They are not selling their product here. So it's harder to get insurance. And so what happens with families is they spend down what they do have of the seniors' assets, and then when they have pretty much run out, they apply for a Medicaid waiver. And it's the Medicaid waiver that continues to pay for the services.
Government funding can always be reduced, so Winger says counting on Medicaid isn't a good plan. And Hahn says too often people are trying to become informed and make arrangements when they already have their hands full.
I think in general that people really aren't prepared. They are usually confronted with the caregiving situation before they really seek the information that they need.
Hahn says the AARP website offers a wealth of information about long-term care and links to other resources. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Brightly colored wooden fish signs have been posted along Bethel Roads this summer. The signs, with conservation messages, come in a year of king salmon closures never seen before on the Kuskokwim River. But just as quickly as the signs went up, they've been disappearing. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Renee Athanas' white Subaru is loaded full of colorful salmon-shaped signs as she heads toward Bethel's Boat Harbor. Kids painted one side during a recent Saturday market. On the back are messages she hopes will build awareness about conserving Kuskokwim king salmon.
Well, we're at Watson's Corner, and we're heading towards the Boat Harbor. And we're passing some fish right now that say, save today, more tomorrow. Just meaning that if you conserve a little bit now and let there be some escapement, eat some of the other fish that we have, like whitefish that are in the river, we'll have more kings in the future for my grandson.
As we pull up to the boat harbor, Athanas' grandson, Landon, and her son, Ryan Burke, jump out to help her put up the signs. After 2013 showed the weakest king salmon run on record, and not having made escapement in two of the past 4 years, managers of the Kuskokwim River fishery are not allowing directed king salmon fishing. They've been trying to get enough kings to spawning grounds before opening the fishery to nets targeting other species of salmon. Many in Bethel, like Athanas and her son, support the conservation measures. Burke says the message of the Gorilla Public Art Project is important.
I'm helping my mom out as a volunteer to put up these signs to help, let people know we should conserve our fish for future generations. Because I think if we overfish them and they're all gone and they won't come back, there's not going to be any more fish for people to have, especially kings.
And we want them facing out so people on the river can see them, right?
The mother-son-grandson team nail the wooden fish onto small posts and pound them into the sandy bank, placing rocks at the base of the signs to keep them from blowing over. When they're done, the four signs they've pounded in read, "Let's save Cusco Kings." Just then, a truck pulls up from Bethel's tribe, ONC.
My name is Roberta Chavez, and I'm the partner's fishery biologist for ONC. We were just talking about who is putting up these fish signs, because we're ONC is really supporting the conservation measures of the Chinook salmon. So we're happy that, you know, these fish signs are going up.
But not everybody likes the signs. Critics of the closures say the Alaska Native subsistence fishers who depend most on the fish are unfairly burdened with the brunt of conservation measures and believe that managers should do more to crack down on commercial bycatch. During a recent tribal fish forum of the Upete Nation, a consortium of federally recognized tribes pushing for more tribal sovereignty, Ed Johnstone, a leader with the Quinault Indian Tribe and the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission, said the signs are divisive.
I see the signs out here along the road that say, you know, king salmon are important and let them grow. I'm going to say that's not really a good thing. It pits people against each other. It starts to talk about, oh, well, if you just don't catch any king salmon, everything's going to be good. That's not true. We don't know what the problem is as I hear it. I don't know if it's the upriver habitat and the spawning grounds or it's marine survival rate in the ocean.
Whether it's people who agree with John Stone or simply vandals, many of the signs have gone missing over the past couple of weeks. Some have been strategically removed to reverse the message, like one along the highway that used to read, "Eat more chicken," and then read, "Eat more." Another said, "Extinction is forever," but the only remaining sign now says just, "Forever." And the ones that Athanas put up with her son and grandson near the boat harbor went down 4 or 5 days after they put them up. Athanas says she's done putting signs along the roads and instead plans to make them into a more permanent art installation in a more protected location. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson and Daisha Eaton in Bethel, Lisa Fu in Juneau, Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, Dan Bross and Aaron Berner in Fairbanks, and Ann Hillman and Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. Join the majority of Alaskans who understand that exposure to secondhand tobacco smoke endangers their health. The toxins in secondhand smoke go everywhere the blood flows, to all organs of the body, creating cellular changes that lead to cancer, heart attack, and stroke, miscarriage, and other diseases. For more information on how to eliminate exposure to secondhand smoke, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.